A couple weeks ago, we discussed practice in kind of a systematic or almost analytical way, and we didn't quite finish with that conversation, so we're going to pick that up again today. With the caveat that an understanding that essentially this is a very careful and delicate thing that we're doing, and that essentially no words can reach it. Nevertheless, we talk about it a lot. We try to talk about it a lot. Even though no words reach it, it itself does speak. It itself does have a voice. And you could say, we are that voice. So let's try to talk about this experience a little bit, okay? We're going to begin. Maybe let's begin with Dogen Zenji. It goes something like this, that when the Genjo Koan, the beginning of the Genjo Koan, that when all dharmas are the Buddha Dharma, even motorcycles, when all dharmas, that means all phenomena, all things, all of our experiences, all events, when all of existence is not separate from, is the same thing as the Buddha way, as the way of awakening, the way of liberation. When all dharmas are this Buddha Dharma, then of course there will be illusion. It will include illusion, and it will include enlightenment. It will include practice or cultivation. It will include birth and death. It will include ordinary beings and Buddha beings. When these myriad dharmas, when all this experience and all these things, all this phenomena, are encountered without self, with no self, with the release or dispersion of self, then it is said there's no delusion, and there's no enlightenment. There's no generation, and there's no extinction. There's no ordinary being, and there's no Buddha. Yet with these myriad dharmas, unconstrained by any duality, such as the fullness of something or its the absence of something, it nonetheless can be available as both illusion and enlightenment, as both generation and extinction, as both ordinary being and Buddha. Even though we might recognize this, still we begrudge the fading of a flower and are dismayed by the flourishing of weeds. So to practice and attempt to confirm existence by conveying a self to it is delusion. For existence itself to come forward as practice, confirming you, that's enlightenment. Those who greatly wake up their delusion, thoroughly wake up their delusion, are called Buddhas. Those who are deluded with the idea of awakening are ordinary beings. And also, there are those who are awakened even beyond any idea of awakening, and those deluded even in the midst of their delusion. So there is just this. There is just the seeing of forms and the hearing of sounds with body and mind as one, and making this intimate, making this intimately its own, fully knowing it. But this knowing is not like a reflection in a mirror, or like the moon reflected on the water. It's direct. In seeing one side, you will not see the other side. So, therefore, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self, or to learn the self, is to drop off self. And to drop off self is to be confirmed by all existence. And to be confirmed by all existence is to effect the dropping off of body and mind identity, and the dispersion of any identity beyond it as well. So what Dogen is saying to us, what Dogen is saying to us is that, where do we begin? Where do we begin? We begin locally. What do we have? We have what's local? Us, right? Self. We work with ourselves, we look at ourselves, we see ourselves, we study ourselves, we meet ourselves. just like going to the farmer's market and faithfully just buying local produce, you know, to support your local farmer. We're supporting our local realm. We're not having grand ideas about some other realms. We're working with what's right here. So we study ourselves, we meet ourselves. And if we thoroughly meet ourselves, we forget ourselves. We drop off ourselves, we disperse ourselves. And in the process of dispersing ourselves, everything, the whole world, comes forward and supports and confirms you. That's the proposition of Dogen Zenji. So when we do this meditation work, We're working locally. We're working with what we have. What do we have? This is our kind of setup here. We make a situation where we're deliberately very contained, and we're very still, and we're quiet, and we have an opportunity to very closely meet this body and this mind just as they are. And this is a courageous activity. This is against the current. The ordinary current is to fill up or to flood our life with many activities or much entertainment or much diversion. But we're deliberately turning around and looking at just body and just mind and saying, what is this? What's here? What's happening? Everybody with me so far? Yeah? That's the proposition of practice, and that's what we're trying to meet. So, Michael, I promised you and some others that I'd finish the 9 stages. So a couple in this investigation of what practice is, a couple weeks ago we looked at these 2 aspects of meditation, what they are. One is the Chinese character for it literally means stopping. It's called shamatha in Sanskrit. Shamatha means meditative absorption. It means one-pointedness. It means settling, calming, pacifying, placing yourself. That's shamatha. And the other, that's one wing of meditation. And the second wing of meditation is called vipassana. Vipassana literally means precise seeing. The Chinese character just means to see. How do you pronounce it? Ji.
I need to see it.
So these are the 2 wings of meditation. If we get involved too much in settling, pacifying, we kind of miss the experience. We're not being mindful and not being alert, not being present. And if we're too involved in vipassana, we might get a little too excited or mentally involved and actually not place ourselves here, not settle. So this is the classical definition of practice, shamatha vipassana. The 2 wings of meditation make this bird of practice fly out, fly forward. So what we talked about last time was we went through a stage-based description of shamatha, of settling or placing. And there's 9 stages. Briefly, the 9 stages are the first stage is placing the mind. The second stage is extended placement or extended fixation, extended resting. The third is refixing or resettling. The fourth is what's called close fixation or close settling or resting near. And I'll go over these a little bit. And the fifth one is called discipline. The sixth one is called pacifying or making peaceful, calming. And the seventh is called introspection. The eighth is called joyous effort. And the ninth is called spontaneous engagement. So some of us have heard, we talked about these first stages before. And what I'm going to do as kind of a way for us to get back into it is read the Dalai Lama's description of these nine stages. And by the way, in Zen teaching, usually these stages or bhumis are not emphasized at all. We just say, sit down and look at body and mind. Very simple. We'll follow your breath, perhaps. But there's not a sense of any progression or stages like that. So we can look at these as stages, but we can also look at them as a kind of description of the whole process as it's unfolding. And I should mention too that we traditionally have a focus or an object of our meditation. Not always, like in a kind of pure form of Zen practice is formless practice. It's called shikantaza. It's sitting just for itself. And that kind of sitting has no specific object or focus. But conventionally, we are aware of placing our attention on something, on a specific object. Usually it's a breath. The most common one is the breath. That's the traditional placement of your attention. But it's not the only one. In fact, the early Buddhists had 40 objects of meditation that had to do with, like an image of a Buddha was one of them. The four elements that we chanted with the Sandokai, with the chant that we chanted this morning, that's four more. There's many objects of meditation. But the most traditional one is the awareness of breath. So, but the Dalai Lama is actually using the image of the Buddha as the object of meditation here. So the Dalai Lama says, whatever your object of meditation, whether it be the nature of your mind or the image of the Buddha, you go through nine stages in the development of calm abiding. Calm abiding is his translation of shamatha. The first stage involves placing the mind on its object of concentration. This stage is called placement. At this stage, you have difficulty remaining concentrated for more than a brief moment, and you feel that your mental distractions have increased. You often drift away from the object, sometimes forgetting it completely. You spend more time on other thoughts and have to devote great effort to bringing your mind back to the object. Can anyone relate to that? I can relate to that. I'm very familiar with the first stage. Yeah. Here's the second stage. When you are able to increase the length of time that you remain focused on your chosen object to a few minutes, you have attained the second stage. This stage is called continual placement. Your periods of distraction are still greater than your periods of concentration, but you do experience fleeting moments of focused mental stillness. That's the second stage. The third stage is, eventually, you become able to immediately catch your mind as it becomes distracted and reestablish its focus. This is the third stage, replacement. You replace your mind back on the object. of concentration, your breath or posture or whatever. The fourth stage, by the fourth stage called close placement, you have developed mindfulness to the extent that you do not lose focus of your object of concentration. However, this is when you become vulnerable to intervals of intense laxity and excitement. The main antidote is the awareness that you are experiencing them. As you are able to apply antidotes to the most obvious manifestations of laxity and excitement, we might call these tension or mental excitement or even sleepiness associated with laxity. As you apply antidotes to the most obvious manifestations of laxity and excitement, there is a danger of subtle forms of laxity arising. The fifth stage is disciplining. In this stage, introspection is used to identify subtle laxity and to apply its antidote. Again, the antidote is your awareness of this subtle laxity. And the sixth stage is, by the sixth stage, pacification, subtle laxity no longer arises. Emphasis is thus placed on applying the antidote to subtle excitement. Your introspection must be more powerful as the obstacle is more subtle. That is, subtle excitement is more subtle, is harder to catch than laxity. The seventh stage, when through continual and concentrated effort you have managed to keep subtle forms of laxity and excitement from arising, your mind does not need to be overly vigilant. The seventh stage, thorough pacification has been attained. The eighth stage is when, with some initial exertion, you can place your mind on its object and are able to remain focused without the slightest experience of laxity or excitement, you have attained the eighth stage. We call this single-pointed. And finally, the ninth stage. The ninth stage. Balanced placement is attained when your mind remains placed on its object effortlessly for as long as you wish. True calm abiding is achieved after attaining the ninth stage by continuing to meditate with single-pointed concentration until you experience a blissful pliancy of body and mind. It's important to maintain a skillful balance in your daily practice between application of single-pointed concentration and analysis. If you focus too much on perfecting your single-pointed concentration, your analytical ability may be undermined. On the other hand, if you are too concerned with analyzing, you may undermine your ability to cultivate steadiness, to remain focused for a prolonged period of time. You must work at finding an equilibrium between the application of calm abiding and analysis. So these are the words of the Dalai Lama on these nine stages that we talked about. Any comments, any questions, any thoughts? Everybody got it? Everybody's in the ninth stage, so no problem, right? How does it feel? Does it feel a little strange to be talking about it this way, as nine stages?
No? Can I ask for a little refresher? Shamatha, Vipassana, and one-pointed concentration is shamatha? Is that
yes, right? That's right. That's shamatha.
Okay.
Yeah. Shamatha. The Sanskrit word shamatha means sama. Its root is sama. It means to be unified or connected, to be placed, to be with something. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Whereas vipassana means to... Vipassana is sometimes associated with mindfulness, sati. It means you're clear. You're ready. You're aware of what's going on. You're not spacing out. You're not... ignoring at all.
You're so when he said analysis, that's what he meant. He meant vipassana.
He meant vipassana, yeah.
Oh, okay.
And the word analysis to me sounds a little too, I don't know, scientific or critical in that way. Mm-hmm. But
okay.
Anything else? Yeah.
I think it is interesting that in Zen we typically don't talk about this. It's almost like we focus on shamatha and just sit.
Mm.
But in Tibetan Buddhism, people study this almost ahead of practice, so they know what they're going into and what stage they're at and what stage to aim for. So it feels like very different approaches. I can see the merit of both,
mm-hmm.
but when I read these lists in Tibetan Buddhism, it also feels very daunting to know that there are all these things, and it's so easy to feel like you're in one or two most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just interested in your personal view about how to use both, because almost this is, feels like analysis or vipassana in one sense, what you know, these 9 points
mm-hmm.
versus shamatha. So how do you these two wings how to use both, or do we, because we're here in Zen, do we just sit?
When I was first began this practice, my meditation instruction was very, very simple. My instructor basically said to taught me the basic posture of sitting down, and he said to just watch your mind, be attentive of your posture, and watch your mind. And if you get distracted, bring your presence to the rhythm of your breath. So that was it. So. I'm really grateful for the kind of succinctness of that practice, because I didn't right away. I had to drive this cushion. I had to steer this cushion by myself. In other words, like I sometimes feel with practices like of this kind that have stages and so on, that it's like getting in a bus and having someone else be the driver. You have the method or the process being the driver, whereas I had to steer from the very beginning, and I developed a kind of intimacy, a kind of you could say a kind of personal intimacy with the practice that was not someone else's experience. So, but on the other hand, I have a very analytical nature, and that this is very interesting to me. And it's very interesting particularly to go back and to see, I particularly these middle stages, like the stage of when they talk about subtle laxity, to say, oh, that's what I experienced. I was I was placed. I was settled, and I was placed. But I really wasn't present I was kind of indulging in the dream of meditation, and the antidote for that is to come back. The next one, discipline, is to come back, is to actually kind of tighten the situation up, to actually tame the mind, to actually bring it into focus. And I remember doing that in my process. So, in a certain sense, like, this confirms the experience. But I wonder if I'd had this definition before. I don't think it would have been very good for me, because I don't know, because it's kind of like an assignment, like a method or an assignment. Yeah. So, and there's a part of me that resists. Does that equate with anyone else? I resist assignments. Yeah.
Implicit in those stages, it is focus on an object.
Yes.
Understanding that correctly?
Yeah. Yeah.
And the object remains the same object. You don't focus on a series of different objects. It's one particular object. In his case, it's the Buddha.
Could be the breath.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. In Zen, sometimes we're aware of being located. So they say, attend to your posture, attend to your sense of being embodied.
And that can be seen as an object.
Yes. Yeah, that can be a focus. Yeah.
How is it like a mantra, a mantram in the Hindu tradition?
Usually a mantra has some implicit empowerment in it, so it's for a specific goal.
It takes you somewhere, you mean, the mantra?
As I see that, I say that's not always true, but some mantras have like a Dharani, they invoke a kind of, or meant to invoke a kind of power or energy from the outside, you know. But or sort of coalescing your own energy from the inside. But mantram has in common a kind of focusing device. It brings the mind. It's like, you could say it's a form of shamatha practice, because it concentrates or places the mind on one thing. It's kind of like Jesus saying, if you're faithful in very little, you'll also be faithful in very much.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're true, if you have fidelity to this one thing, you can have fidelity to everything. You know, if you're really with that one thing, if you really love that one person, if you're really devoted and love that one person, and you know, and you're well, you could say you're well experienced in what it is to love that one person, then in loving that one person, you can love others. And sometimes they say that about yourself. You know, if you love yourself, then you can really love others.
And the mantra? The mantra is the object of that love? Is that... How does that...
No, I'm just using that as an example of being single, placing, mm-hmm. single-mindedly placing on an object. So, mantrams helps to focus the mind sometimes, mm-hmm. and it's a device. But following your breath, you could say, is a device, or staring at a wall is a device. Or,
so
it's just a matter of degrees.
Yeah. Is it kind of a focusing in order to open out? I mean, it seems to me
I would say so.
I can maintain an image of all kind, you know, an image for a long time, but meanwhile I'm doing a lot of other things. Yeah, multitasking, in other words. And
I know.
I guess that's laxity. It's a form of laxity. But then again, if you're going to go in and focus in on one object, isn't there an opening out as well?
That's exactly right. And like I just mentioned, like what Jesus said, if you're faithful in this one thing, if you love that one person, then
so
with that focus, you're able to love others, thoroughly love others too.
So it brings in everyone.
That's right. Yeah. That's the function of. That's the function of shamatha. Yeah. So you place. Sometimes it's called. Sometimes it's called placing the mind. But it's also called fixing the mind. It's called resting the mind. So you bring the mind to a place, you know, like to a wall, you know, or you bring it to your body and mind. Now, in the Zen tradition, Shikantaza tradition, there's a sense of once you get your mind settled and placed on one object, say the breath, then you can relax or release that fixity. And in a certain sense, you expand your object of meditation. So instead of your object of meditation being this narrow attention to your breath, it's still breath, but it's breath with the sound of the blue jays, and it's breath with the motorcycles going by, and it's breath with the pain in your knee, and it's breath with your distracted thoughts, and it's breath with your emotional production. So your breath, well, this is one way of talking about it. So the object of meditation becomes very, you're confident that you're settled, and being confident that you're settled, anything becomes your object of meditation. And you can give your attention to whatever you want, as long as you want, until your attention goes somewhere else. But it's not that you're distracted. It's that you choose to place it here and place it there. But you're still being present throughout all that. That's Shikantaza. It has no form. It has, in fact, it's almost inseparable. Not inseparable, but it's hard to see it as a specific practice separate from ordinary mind. It is ordinary mind. It's ordinary mind that's present, you know, that's ready.
I can't help but keep thinking about, I don't know if it was Alan Watts, but he said that recipe over the meal. You look at the recipe, but you're missing the meal.
Good metaphor, yeah. This is like a map or a recipe.
Is that Alan Watts?
I don't know.
But that, I think, so simple, and yet has so much in it for me. Because and then I was thinking about how people can describe wine. It's almost like you could almost Pavlov kind of thing, almost like you start to salivate just by the. But it's not that. It's not the meal, really. I suppose it could be the way I guess I kind of see it. It's like a kind of form. and linked to emptiness, right? Just like the sounds that I'm making now and hitting your ear are a certain form. The meal is
body and mind.
The breath is also, as you said, this is what I feel is so, I'm so drawn to, is also, we are not in the other types of yoga postures, we are in a specific one. It's in the sitting. I can feel it now. I've been sitting here, maybe, I don't know what, half an hour. I can feel it in my butt, you know, in my back. So it's a meal. And I listen to your words, and your words are here. It's here. And the breath is here.
That's good that you're recognizing that this is a physical experience. This is a physical experience.
It seems essential.
Yeah.
Because I can get carried away.
It's interesting that we don't think of, we think of exercise or Qigong or some yoga activity as being very physical. We don't think of this as physical, but it is. And even though this posture is very still, inside this stillness is a kind of dynamism. There is movement. You know? The breath is one of them. So to recognize that energy is good. I'm wondering if toward these last stages, the notes I have from Tenzin Roshi are slightly different than the Dalai Lama's description. For the A stage, it's called joyous effort. This is kind of like a graduation stage. It's not like everything's perfect, but we're kind of here at the eighth stage. We're kind of present and we're here, and in other words, like we have our credentials. We've arrived. We're here, and we've already graduated. Now we might not, still remains to be seen what we do with our degree. but we've graduated in a sense. The power is it's an uninterrupted power at this point. It's like Zazen is doing Zazen, breath is doing breath. There's no effort at this point. It's the sense of effort is like. It's not a sense of like pushing or making an effort. It's just happening. Breath is noticing breath, and it's uninterrupted. This is an uninterrupted stage. Did you have something?
I really like the topic, what we're sharing today, because it really. It's kind of like what we're practicing through the weekend. It's just very simplicity, just coming back to the beginning, coming home. And I started thinking of kind of a metaphor of like a Brett Favre. I'm not into sports, but
Brett,
an athlete. And
Brett Favre,
the quarterback. And Tiger Woods.
I'm from Wisconsin. He's from Minnesota.
In honor of Wisconsin. But you'll always hear them say, well, he's a natural. He's a natural. And if you think about that in sports, and if you watch these athletes, and or Tiger Woods, and he's out there, and he's on this course, and he's just one with that movement, and he's able to do things that very few people can do. And Brett Favre, the same way. And they're not, and I'm going somewhere with the story of like Tiger Woods and Brett Favre, but Brett Favre played perfect football till the very end, and he didn't. He, when you're an athlete and you're out there, you're doing that. You're not thinking. You're just kind of, you're one with everything you're doing. You're one with your body. You're one.
I call
that
the zone.
Yeah, the zone. They're in the zone. Tiger Woods, he was the best golfer on the planet until he decided to play around. And after all that went down, you could tell his game changed. Like, he was perfect, the best golfer on the planet, and something happened where he couldn't play anymore. And you look at that and you're like, what happened? It must have been here, because his body didn't change. His capability didn't change. And I kind of feel like that's, I feel very grateful to have the exposure to Shikantaza, because I think it really allows that very natural element of just being your practice. And then all the other the stories and the thoughts and ideas around it are very beautiful. But there's the home, the seed. Would you look at it that way? Is kind of like,
I agree with you. This is basically a coming home practice, we can say. So we have a very creative mind, and we flood our conscious realm with so many thoughts. Mostly have to do with our own identity and our own well-being. But we collectively and singly maintain the world with our flood of thoughts, and yet we know, those of us that are practicing, we know we need to come home to a place that is before thought, or beyond thought, you could say, or beyond our individual construction. So this is a coming home practice. And the last stage, the ninth stage, it's called spontaneous engagement. That was the stage that's equated with equanimity. And that's the jhana where the Buddha woke up, where the Buddha kind of finished his work. It's a stage where it's not a question of effort. It's just a question of presence itself. And you could say that your intimacy with it, your familiarity with this activity, that is your engagement. That itself is your engine. That's your power. You know this. This is you. This is what you do. And that itself helps you meet, you know, is the meaning of this practice. There's one thing I'd like to say in kind of closing, it's more than one thing. It's a kind of, this is not often talked about in Zen either, but practice itself has what's called in Tibetan tradition fruition. And Zen is very careful about this. They say there's no goals, or there's no resultant in and of itself. The practice itself confirms itself. The practice itself takes care of itself. But in a kind of mundane level, or a kind of everyday understanding, we can say that the practice itself has fruition. It has a result. And the result is wisdom. Wisdom. It's being, it's knowing what's going on with you and the world, and the relationship, and the bell. So the resultant of this is that is to see things as they are, to actually come to wisdom. And there's a component to wisdom that we all understand is inherent in wisdom, and that's compassion. So wisdom and compassion are like these two expressions or manifestations of the way. We do come to knowledge in this practice, and we do become very, very, I don't want to say kind, that's almost too deliberate. I'd like to say more, we become tender, we become sensitive, we become vulnerable to things as they are. And if you and this is training in a sense. So, if you train, remember, you will become adept or sensitive to how things are, and to the you could say you become aware of the truth. But in the process of becoming aware of the truth, in becoming vulnerable to the truth, you'll also become vulnerable to what is not true. You can't exclude it. In the process of practice, in the maturation of practice, you will be able to be free of delusion, but you will also become aware of, or you will be able to sensitive to delusion. Nothing's excluded here. You study, it's a complete package. You leave nothing behind. So you will become in the process of this practice. You will hear the cries of the world. You'll become more sensitive to the sufferings of others and yourself. You will feel your pain more. You will become more sensitive and more vulnerable to suffering as well as peace and equanimity. So bear that in mind. Watch out. So in that context, I'd like us to end with the loving kindness or metta practice. So maybe we can say this together. And I'll say a phrase, and then maybe you can murmur it if you don't want to say it out loud. You can repeat after me. So this is the traditional Metta Sutra. We start locally. We start with ourselves. So the first line is, you can repeat after me. May I be happy.
May I be happy.
May I be joyful, free from fear, and live in safety.
May I be joyful, free from fear, and live in safety.
May I be at ease and abide in peace.
May I be at ease and abide in peace.
Now from this place, we bring our attention to others. And specifically, if there's someone that's suffering, we have some Sangha members that are close to death as well. We can extend this to those, or anyone, we feel that it's in need of this. Give our attention to that person. May you be happy.
May you be happy.
May you be joyful, free from fear, and live in safety.
May you be joyful, free from fear, and live in safety.
May you be at ease and abide in peace.
May you be at ease and abide in peace.
Now, finally, we're going to extend this to every being, every being. And as we extend it to every being, we can bear in mind those people that we, maybe there's a few people we have problems with that are hard for us to care for or to feel kindly toward. And as well as extending it to all beings, we can extend it not just to our species, but to all living beings and all creatures, all patterns of existence. May everyone be happy.
May everyone be happy.
May everyone be joyful, free from fear, and live in safety.
May everyone be joyful, free from fear, and live in safety.
And may everyone be at ease and abide in peace.
And may everyone be at ease and abide in peace.